Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Darfur, it's time to end this scandal of international neglect. How one woman journalist braved a man's world. And Father Brand tells us to listen quietly when God speaks. Hardly a day goes by here at the radio in which we do not receive a press release or a news item denouncing the ongoing humanitarian disaster in Darfur, in Western Sudan. The conflict there, which began in February 2003, is mainly between the government-backed Janjaweed, a militia group recruited from local Arab tribes, and the non-Arab peoples of the region. At least 400,000 people have been killed so far, and the violence is described as genocide, as the large majority of the 2.5 million refugees are non-Arab Africans fleeing Janjaweed attacks. Right now, one major and immediate concern for those caught in the conflict is hunger. And one press release in particular caught my attention. It was entitled, Darfur, Time to End the Scandal of International Neglect.
Well, the first thing is that it's in the wake of the human rights abuse. The Irish Catholic bishops are particularly conscious that the people of Darfur are faced with a humanitarian disaster of what one can only regard as truly frightening proportions.
Father Owen Cassidy is a member of the advisory body of the Irish Commission for Justice and Social Affairs. He participated in the issuing of the statement during the general meeting of the Irish Episcopal Conference.
The bishops are conscious that they need to pressurise both the Irish government and all interested bodies to add their voices to those who are calling for an urgent increase in humanitarian aid to relieve the worst effects of humanitarian disaster in Darfur, particularly in the light of the food insecurity, because food insecurity is a growing worry and present. It's estimated that over half the population is reliant on foreign aid. And that what is particularly worrying is the evidence that despite the ceasefire, the distribution of aid to remote regions in Darfur is still being obstructed by the continuing fighting between the government of Sudan and the rebel groups. And this is outrageous and it's unsustainable.
But, I said, hasn't a peace agreement just recently been signed?
Notwithstanding the recent peace agreement, there is increasing evidence that the government-supported Arab Janjaweed militias are obstructing the provision of food aid to the remote areas, where it's reckoned that only 40% of the population can be reached by aid workers. So the Irish Commission for Justice and Social Affairs are really echoing the call by Pope Benedict in his recent weekly address on May the 21st, where he called for concrete and swift action to save hundreds, literally hundreds and thousands of people from starvation in Darfur. So that's the first context within which the statement is issued.
Yes, I remember that well. The Pope expressed his hope that thanks to the contribution of everyone, the scourge of hunger which still afflicts mankind and seriously threatens the lives of millions of people may be overcome.
Penso in primo luogo all'urgente drammatica situazione del Darfur nel Sudan.
Pope Benedict said he's thinking above all about the urgent and tragic situation in the Darfur region of Sudan. However, Father Owen told me there are other issues that also need to be addressed, and the Irish bishop's statement tackles them.
The issue of applying sanctions against the perpetrators of the Darfur conflict. I mean, it's just unacceptable that those who are guilty of human rights abuses are not held answerable before the International Criminal Court in The Hague. And we specifically call on the Irish government to use its influence to ensure that they would be held answerable for their truly frightening use of violence. And the violence is pretty horrendous. I mean, there's evidence of deliberate destruction of homes, grain stores, water sources, the abductions of and mutilations and civilians, and systematic use of rape, and they all offer a fairly sobering picture of ethnic cleansing of the very worst kind. And it's just unacceptable that the perpetrators of these atrocities would not be held accountable before the International Criminal Court, which sits in The Hague.
But, I said, let's get back to the beginning of your statement, in which you say this warfare is one of the most ferocious and yet underreported conflicts of the past decade. That points the finger at journalists, doesn't it?
Yes, unfortunately, human rights atrocities only come to the notice of the public when courageous journalists step into the breach and make things public. I mean, one doesn't have to be reminded of the horrendous nature of the genocide in Rwanda that went almost unnoticed and unreported until it was far too late to gender effective action against it. And the concern at the present time is to ensure that these human rights atrocities would not go unnoticed, would not go unreported, and that those responsible would be held up publicly before the light of public opprobrium for their actions. And that's why there is a very, very strong responsibility on those engaged in the public media to highlight the facts as they are, not to exaggerate, but to simply highlight and to put the facts down for others to judge.
I pointed out that as far as Vatican Radio is concerned, Darfur has been a top news story ever since the conflict began. But I have to agree, not much seems to have been done on the world stage.
Yes, the world stage is a very imperfect forum. And there's increasing evidence, in fact, that some of the greater powers are less than enthusiastic in terms of their desire to confront the relevant authorities. Without placing the blame too firmly on the greater powers, nevertheless, the oil resources in Sudan can tempt some of the countries, such as China, to temper its criticism, and therefore the UN Security Council is less effective because of geopolitical considerations. It's easier to engender an effective response where there are no geopolitical considerations, but unfortunately the world in which we live in is one which that's not the case. This only means that it is of even greater importance that we as non-governmental agencies in many respects and religious bodies highlight and continue to highlight and continue to confront and to challenge governments to confront this situation as it is. Because ultimately, it's only in the international forum, the United Nations, it's only individual governments, it's only the EU, it's only the major power blocks that have the political muscle to, in fact, ensure that atrocities like this come to an end and that those who are responsible are brought to justice. That shows the responsibility of the non-governmental agencies, and particularly the Catholic Church. And in this respect, the Catholic Church is a very honourable track record in highlighting atrocities in regions such as Darfur.
Getting back to your press release, you actually make an appeal. You call on certain entities, and one of these is the public. You call on the Irish public to add their voices to those who are calling for increase in humanitarian aid. What can the public do, Father Cassidy?
The public can create a forum within which politicians and governments find it impossible to ignore human rights abuses. There are many instances of the way in which the public has in fact created an awareness and created a context within which governments act. The most recent example is in East Timor, where the Irish public has organized over a number of years a very effective lobbying group, which in turn brought to the attention of the Irish government, and in turn was a factor in engendering the United Nations assistance for the people of East Timor. But the public has a huge responsibility, and the public can ultimately be the arbiters of what gets attended to and what gets ignored.
The other entities you call on are the Irish government, the Sudanese government, and the Minister for Foreign Affairs.
Yes, our Minister for Foreign Affairs, Mr. Dermot O'Hearn, is visiting Darfur in the next month. And that consequently, we are very conscious of the possibility there of influencing his discourse with the Sudanese government, with a view to ensuring that the Sudanese government accept a UN peacekeeping force in Darfur. This is of the first importance. The African Union peacekeeping force is due to leave by the end of September. It needs to be replaced by an effective, and I stress, an effective UN peacekeeping force that has the resources to protect civilians. There's the other thing that the Irish government need to do, and that is they need to ensure that the Sudanese government provide security for non-governmental agencies who are distributing food aid. There have been some atrocities and some very tragic fatalities of people working in a voluntary capacity for non-governmental agencies in Darfur, and it's utterly unacceptable that the Sudanese government would not provide the necessary security, both the personnel distributing aid and also to ensure that the aid itself is distributed to the remoter regions of Darfur.
As I was squirreling away at my desk the other day, I came across an invitation to attend a lecture given by the British journalist Catherine Whitehorn on the theme Women Journalists in the 21st Century. I couldn't miss that, could I? And not only. Since I discovered Catherine was stopping over in Rome only for a few hours and would be rushing off straight after the lecture, I decided to call her up beforehand, hoping she'd talk to me straight away. She did, and this is how she introduced herself.
Well, I'm a journalist and I've worked for something like 50 years in journalism. I started out in women's magazines and then I had my own column in the Sunday paper, The Observer, for 37 years, I think. And now I'm the agony aunt, that's to say the advice columnist, for a magazine for the over 50s. And everybody laughs when they hear about that and say, do the over 50s have problems? And I can assure you, they do.
37 years on The Observer, well, that means you have a real inside view of what goes on in a newspaper. Have you seen the role of women change during this time?
Yes, I think it has, and I think just as much the way women are written for, has put that differently. And I think also the way newspapers tackle the question of interesting women has changed enormously over that time. When we started, a woman's page was very much just sewing and babies and cooking and so forth. And I had the luck to work for a marvellous man called George Seddon, who more or less invented these women's pages, which aren't women's pages that you get all over the world now. You know, they come out under titles like Style or Currents or something like that. But the idea that women are only interested in the domestic things has completely disappeared. And I was lucky enough to be part of that revolution, if you can call it that.
So, I commented, you're saying that as the role of women in society has changed, so has the role of women reporters.
Yes, but much more to the point, I think people always underestimated the extent to which women wanted something other than the purely domestic. And in any case, they wanted to have much more intimate stuff about what women were really thinking about. In the old days, you didn't write in newspapers about human relationships. You didn't write particularly features on education and medicine and so forth. And the great pioneer was Mary Stott in The Guardian. It was the Manchester Guardian in those days. It was a woman who had been a very good journalist. She wanted to be chief sub-editor. And they said, yes, sorry, but of course you can't be chief sub-editor because you're a woman. You must do the women's pages. So she thought she'd make the women's pages completely different. And they really changed women's journalism completely by tackling anything that one might be interested in, rather than just this very narrow strip of what was really women's work, the cooking and the sewing and so forth.
In the old days, says Catherine, but just as Mary Stott, an excellent journalist, who wanted to become chief sub-editor and couldn't because she was a woman, a recent survey by the American Journalist in the 21st Century shows that although journalists who put out the news every day on TV, radio and print are a more professional group than a decade ago, that although they generally make higher salaries and that more of them have university degrees and are generally older, there are still more men than women on the job. In fact, women are only one-third of all full-time journalists working for the traditional mainstream media, just as they have been since 1982, even though more women than ever are graduating from journalism school and entering the profession. Why, I asked Catherine, is it maybe that women don't market themselves as well as men do?
I think we're brought up to be a little bit more humble, but I would say that an awful lot of women are darn good at marketing themselves now, only it's a question of what you call marketing. Charm is also a marketing tool, and men use that when they can, and women certainly use it. You use what you've got, don't you? I think it's much more that men feel comfortable with having men around them, and they like to have women in a slot. And a slot called the women's page was nice and comfortable. It didn't upset anybody. And I think that to a certain extent, men's desire not to have women around is counterbalanced with young women because they like having pretty girls around. And it was quite interesting. The Oxford and Cambridge colleges, they had women students in the men's colleges long before they had women dons, because pretty girls sitting around saying very true Socrates was very nice. Beady-eyed middle-aged women saying what exactly do you mean by that was much less agreeable to the blokes.
It goes without saying that women are just as good as journalists as men are, obviously. But they do bring different qualities to the job, don't they?
I think they're interested in different things. Oddly enough, there have always been, I only discovered this quite recently, there have always been women reporters, right back to the 19th century. But they had to write the same way as men did. They had to report the same things that the male editors wanted, which was facts, facts, facts. And I think that women are very much more interested in the way people feel about things. That you will have a man who will read the education bill or what's said in Parliament about it. The women will want to know what it's going to be like for me and my child when they move to school. They're much more immediate concern with how things affect me and what I feel about it. And I think it's that women's perspective that's now very present in journalism, and I don't think it used to be.
Just the other day, I did an interview with a woman who's fighting, she's involved in fighting desertification. I don't know if you know, this is the year for deserts. But anyway, she was saying how important it is to empower women as to really make a difference to saving the environment. She said that in tribal cultures, it's the women who can change the course of things. Can you relate to that at all in your field?
I can relate to it a bit in what she's saying, in the sense that a lot of these initiatives that are done in third world countries, if they're done through the men, they're done through a power structure, and there's a terrible gap for corruption or for vainglory, you might say. Whereas if they're done through the women, they're right down at the village level and they actually get to, you know, that well, those children, that small square of garden. I do think women are much better at getting things done on the ground than men because they want different things. So I think, you know, they try to get women interested in recycling their plastic bags and pressure groups and so forth, because I think they go about things in different ways. We're brought up to do it much more by getting hold of one other person and doing it that way, whereas men want a hierarchy of some kind, and a hierarchy is not necessarily the best way of getting things done.
A woman's perspective seems to me a fundamental thing in running the world today, and that means in politics, in education, and of course in information. Catherine agrees with a touch of cynicism.
I think so long as there are a lot of women doing it, and so long as people realize that you need to have women because women buy things and the advertisers want to get at women, and I know it's cynical, but that is a key card that we hold, and I don't see us giving it up in a hurry.
And what about your hopes for women journalists in the 21st century, I said? Isn't that the theme of your lecture this afternoon?
Well, simply that I've no idea how things will go in the future, but I think that the basic difference between a woman's way of looking at things and a man's way of looking at things will remain. So I hope a woman's voice goes on being heard.
I think women's voices not only must go on being heard, I think they should get stronger and stronger as 50% of humankind looks to the future with hopes for a better and more just world for its children. And now Father Jim Brand, Spiritual Director of the Pontifical Beda College in Rome, tells us how important it is to listen, to turn off the bright lights, and to pray in silence.
Last week, I was looking at the amazing thing that's happening when a messenger sent by God to Mary at the Annunciation in Luke chapter 1, verses 26 onwards. That the first thing the messenger does was to greet the lady, then compliment her, tell her she's full of God's love, and then said, "Do not fear." And I looked at the things that might stop us being afraid of God. Then we have another commandment that we don't often hear preached about. Listen. Listen. It's very hard to listen. Most people are broadcasting. Often when we're pretending to listen to somebody else's conversation or the insights, we're getting ready our own response. And we're thinking, what will be my intervention next? Because we're very good at broadcasting, not very good at receiving. And in prayer, it requires interior silence to hear God giving us pillow talk. He whispers in our ears, he doesn't shout. It means turning off our vulgar lights so that the stars come out. Because God's lights aren't always vulgar and bright. I know people who've gone to an island off England for a sort of meditative weekend and taken the radio with them. The radio's blaring all the time. People shouldn't be afraid of silence. That's where God is. And it's only when we're very quiet that we can hear his whispers. Listen. And then the message. The angel says to Mary, "Will you allow me, the Spirit, to love you?" Oh, that's the invitation that God gives to us all. Will you allow me to love you? Earlier I was mentioning that he stands at the door and knocks. I mean, there are some missioners who get their foot in the door and won't go. Frankly, invasive. The courtesy of the Lord is that he can only love us to the extent we give him permission. And that's the invitation he gives to all of us. Now, which part of my home am I inviting him into? Do I just invite him into the front porch? Or do I invite him into my formal rooms? Can he come into the drawing room that I know is tidy? Or will I invite him into the kitchen that's all over the shop with 3 weeks washing up still waiting to be done? Will I invite him into the intimate part of my house, the bedroom area? I know I've got a loft with all sorts of things in my life that I've put aside, not known how to deal with. Nasty memories, spooks. It's even frightening to go on one's own into the loft. There are probably diamonds in there as well as rubbish. How far have I allowed him into my home? Because I'm not holy enough to discern what is of value and what isn't. Only he can help me clear the loft of these spooks and these ghosts and these past memories, some happy, some sad. So he's asking permission for us to love him. And then Mary needed reassurance. We all need reassurance. And that's what we're all doing for each other, to reassure each other. That's what the church is about. It's a companionship. It's a fellowship. for us to reassure each other, because we're all in this together. No man is an island. Okay. And so the angel says to her, well, you go and see your cousin St. Elizabeth. She's beyond childbearing age and she's 6 months pregnant. That'll make her hair stand on end. Mary thought, well, if it can happen to her, perhaps it can happen to me. Now, most of the people in the church today who are most upset are people who sit behind desks. They must, like Mary, go on a walkabout and see the wonders that are happening around them. I'm going to be 71 shortly. I've seen all the changes in the church. I fought them to start with, being a Pharisee of the Pharisees, and then I realised, who am I? It's not my church, it's the Holy Spirit's church. I must let go. And on the walkabouts I've had, I've seen miracles. Do you know somebody who's sad and has been kissed better? Oh, only the Holy Spirit does that. The evil one doesn't. Do you know someone who's left out and has been brought in? That's a wonder. Do you know someone who thought they were stupid and have been reassured? Do you know somebody who's sick and has been looked after by their family? Do you know people who live together for 50, 60 years and love each other still? We live in a world that broadcasts misery. No wonder it depresses people. There is good news out there if one will get off one's chair, like Mary, and go on a walkabout and see the wonders that God is doing. My country is still an island of saints. You wouldn't think so from the news. And be a universalist. To be a patriot is wonderful. You can only love the world in general if you love somewhere in particular, because the world in general doesn't exist. But if you're a nationalist, you've cut yourself off from Christ. As we shall see later, all the nations and all the tribes are going to be in heaven, so we might as well get used to a multicultural world now, because that's what heaven will be like. And England, thank goodness, is a multicultural society. We're getting ready for heaven. So let's go and walk about among all the cultures, all the languages, all the religions, all the colours, and see the wonders that are going on in the world. Then Mary went into a crisis. A crisis is where the scales are sort of balanced. You wonder what's going to happen. Over his last quartet, Beethoven wrote the words, muss es sein? Es muss sein. Must it be? It must be. And whenever the Lord asks us things, there is a crisis. The whole of the created world must have been on tiptoes. What is she going to say? What will she say? And eventually she said, I consent. Yes, be it done to me. And that's what faith is. I consent to being loved. I consent to your will, O Lord. Amen.
That's all from the English feature program today, but we'll be back at the same time tomorrow, so join us then. Laudetur Jesus Christus.